ദ റിയൽ പർപ്പസ് ഓഫ് ദ പ്രിലൂഡ്. റിനോവേറ്റഡ് സ്പിരിറ്റ് സിംഗിൾഡ് ഔട്ട്. വാട്സ്വർത്ത് ഹാസ് എസ്കേപ്ഡ് ഫ്രം ദാറ്റ് വേഴ്സ് സിറ്റി ഓഫ് ലണ്ടൻ വെയർ ഹി ഹാഡ് ലോങ് ഫൈൻഡ് എ ഡിസ്കണ്ടന്റഡ് സോർസ്നർ. The unexpected legacy from his friend Wesley Calvert has greatly relieved him from his pecuniary trouble. The poet is on his way to Raystown from Bristol with the sweet breath of heaven that was caressing his cheeks, the poet felt within the correspondent breeze. This was the breeze of poetic inspiration of creative arts, and very soon poetic numbers came spontaneously to cloth in priestly robe. Renovated spirit singled out, such hope was mine for holy services. So in the very post preamble to the prelude book 1, we find that Wordsworth feels himself to be a renovated spirit singled out for holy services, and while the poet was taking rest in a green shady place, settling into gentler happiness. A higher power than fancy gave assurance of some work of glory there forthwith to be begun, perhaps two there performed. Work of glory. And what was to be this work of glory? It was to be the Recluse, a great philosophical poem which is keeping with the aspirations of Coleridge, was to deliver upon the authority a system of philosophy after assuming the station of man in repose. One whose principles were made up, it was his friend Coleridge, the guardian angel of Wordsworth's poetical genius, who both guided as well as inspired the poet to compose this great philosophic song that was to be the monumental work of his life. Why then the prelude? Then how does the prelude come in the picture at all? For the answer, let us hear from the poet himself. Let us quote some relevant portion of Wordsworth's preface to the first edition of Escutcheon in 1814. Several years ago, when the author retired to his native mountains with the hope of being enabled to construct a literary work that might live, it was a reasonable thing that we should take to review of his own mind and examine how far nature and education had qualified him for such employment. A subsidiary to this preparation, he undertook record in verse the origin and progress of his own powers as far as he was acquainted with them, the work addressed to a dear friend, most distinguished for his knowledge and genius, and to whom the author's intellect is deeply indebted, has been long finished, and the result of the investigation which gave rise to it was a determination to compose a philosophical poem containing views on man, nature and society, and to be entitled The Recluse, as having for its principal subject the sensations and the opinions of a poet living in retirement. The preparatory poem is biographical and conducts the history of author's mind to the point when he was emboldened to hope that his faculties were sufficiently matured for entering upon the arduous labor which he had proposed to himself. And the two works have the same kind of relation to each other, if he may so express himself, as the anti-chapel has to the body of Gothic church. Main purpose. Thus the main purpose of composing the prelude seems to be crystal clear from Wordsworth's own statement in the above passages. It was to be his preparatory poem just to find out his faculties were sufficiently matured to undertake the arduous task of composing the great philosophic poem that was to be the monumental work of his life. Now let us come to the prelude itself. In Book 1, there are so many important lines where we find the poet very clearly stating his reasons for writing the prelude. It was to be a sort of introduction to that great poem, The Recluse, as Wordsworth must be beginning to realize that a poem on his early development might make a valuable introduction. Proceeding towards the chosen value in that splendid evening like a pilgrim resolute, the poet's soul once more made trial of her strength, nor lagged well in visitations, but the harp was soon defrauded and banded host of harmony dispersed in straggling sounds, and lastly utter silence. Hopes and disappointments. After settling down at his hermitage at Raystown, the poet felt that he might be able to give poetic or visible expression to some vague fancies and longings that were drifting about aimlessly in his mind for many years. Alas, the poet is sadly disappointed once more. Welcome light dawns from the east, but dawns to disappear and mocks me with the sky and ripens not into a steady morning. So we find that whenever the poet desires to tackle some exalted theme, he finds impediments from day to day renowned. Still, Wordsworth doesn't absolutely give way to dejection and despair. For the time being, the poet decides to give up his idea of a lofty theme and makes up his mind to remain satisfied with the present gifts of humbler industry. In fact, during 1798, Wordsworth wrote some modest type of poems like the Cumberland Beggar, the Discharged Soldier, and also the nice, subtler and simpler poems to be included in the Lyrical Ballads and Peter Bell. Self-analysis and the quest of a theme. After this, we find the poet again subjecting himself to severe self-analysis, making a thorough investigation of his mind to find if he is fit enough for undertaking an arduous task of writing a great epic. And the result seems to be much encouraging. Wordsworth had an ambitious soul and Milton was his poet hero. He must leave behind some lofty work to bring everlasting fame and glory. So the poet is in quest of a suitable theme and suitable setting in time and place for his work of glory. And first of all, his mind turns to some old romantic tale by Milton left unsung. This signifies what Wordsworth's first cherished desire is, to emulate Milton, whom he considers to be his great ideal. Next, we find the poet in quest of various other subjects. They are chivalry and great warlike deeds of medieval knights, the noble and brave exploits of great heroes like Mithridates, Odin, Sertorius, Dominique de Gorgias, Gustavus, and far-famed Scottish hero Wallace. The poet also feels that it would suit him better to invent a story from his own heart. And finally, my last and favorite aspiration mounts with yearning towards some philosophic song of truth that cherishes our daily life, immortal words, thoughtfully fitted to the often lyre. Mental conflicts and the memories of childhood days. But still the poet recoils from such an arduous task. He is hesitant to make a choice due to the lack of confidence in his old powers. He seeks consolation from the fond hope that advancing years will endow him with mature power of thinking and clearer insight to compose such a lofty poem. Ultimately, we find that all his mental conflicts and contradictions and his doubts and diffidence to undertake the great task of composing an exalted poem on a noble theme and send the poet's mind back to those childhood days which he has passed amid the most lovely and sublime sights and sounds of nature of the Lake District of England. So in the subsequent part of Book 1, we find that the transition to autobiographical incidents and recollections of unforgettable experience of childhood days that contributed to the growth and development of poet's mind have been done with wonderful ease and naturalness. Reviving and recreating experience of childhood days. Both in Book 1 and Book 2, through vivid and minute descriptions of boyhood sports and pastimes like bathing, kite sailing, sketching, bird snaring, expedition in stolen boat, boat races and riding expeditions, the poet tells us of this incomparable experience of his childhood when his sense and soul was one. Helen Derbyshire was truly absurd, but a deliberately cultivated memory. He could live intensely in the past, he could revive and recreate, and the chief part of his purpose in the prelude is to recall and quicken into permanent life those pregnant moments, for they were, he well knew, the making of him as a poet. Professor Herbert Lindberger, a critic of the age from USA, also holds the same opinion when he says, but the repeated invocations of past visions in the prelude are something other than inventions or limitations of past actions. They are above all an attempt to recreate and restore. By verbal means, a past order which can give substance to the future, and the poet himself tells us, yes, I remember when the changeful earth and twice five summers on my mind and stamped the face of the moving year, even then I held unconscious intercourse with beauty, old as creation, drinking in a pure organic pleasure from the silver wreaths of curling mist or from the leashed plain of waters colored by impending clouds. Reviver of hopes and confidence. Let us see now how far as the poet has been able to achieve his main purpose. In the middle of his first book, he found the poet full of regrets as he was unprofitably traveling toward the grave like a false steward who hath much received and renders nothing back. But at the end, we find the same poet expressing his earnest hope that recollection of his childhood days may refresh his thoughts and restore the balance of his unsteady mind. Yet Wordsworth has overcome his depression mood of dejection and frustration. The act of composing of the prelude had some sort of rapturous effect on his mind. And before the very close, the poet very confidently tells Coleridge, a dear friend, most distinguished for his knowledge and genius, one end at least hath been attained, my mind hath been revived. And then he has tends to add to remind him of his main purpose of writing this poem. I choose it rather at this time than work of ampler and more varied argument where I might be discomfited and lost. That is why Wordsworth gives up his idea of beginning his great and highly ambitious epic-like poem. He recalls for a while, but the most surprising and ironic element in the matter is that the Gothic church of the poet's dream was never completed, expecting a new 100 lines of the excursion. The intermediate part on this preparatory poem, intended to serve as a portico, the recluse became his work of glory. Immortal words, a monumental work of an extraordinary type of holy pen of the high priest of nature.